Honorable Court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We're going to start by introducing ourselves. This gets a little complicated in the pandemic era. I'm Mike Attican, the Chief Justice, and by seniority on the bench, you will notice that there are six of us here in the courtroom, and Justice Millie Newman, who will now introduce herself, is on WebEx.
Good morning, Justice Miller Lerman here by WebEx. Thank you.
Good morning, William Cancel.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Jonathan Babbitt.
And John Freidemer.
Thank you very much. Lawyers, thank you for keeping your masks on when you are not speaking, but please take your mask off when you are presenting to the court so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. And with that, does anybody have any questions? Thank you very much then. Mr. Becker, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm Ted Becker on behalf of the appellant Miller Gutter. This action was purportedly dismissed for failure to effectuate service in accordance with Nebraska Revised Statute 25217, which at the time of the order, the one in effect at the time the complaint filed, provided 6 months to effectuate service. It had subsequently, within a later effective date, that was changed to 180 days, but that amendment does not factor into this case given the timing of the filing of this suit.
Let me ask you about that. Isn't that statute a procedural statute?
Yes.
And don't we generally say that procedural statutes take effect and govern in any case that's not yet final?
In this case, Your Honor, I believe that the amendment to the statute had an effective date to the statute that provided that it was effective from a date certain going forward. And so I believe in this case, given that the unicameral elected a effective date for the statute and the amendments thereto, I believe that the intent was that it apply prospectively going forward.
Well, it didn't say prospectively anywhere in the text, did it?
Well, it had an effective date on the statute, and just logically, you can't deprive someone under ex post facto or other principles of a right if you have an action where you have 6 months to effectuate service on the date that you file it. You can't thereby thereafter deprive a party of their right by changing the statute at a later time to reduce the time to effectuate service. At the time this case was filed, there was 6 months to effectuate service, and that was accomplished in this case.
In any of the cases where we have talked about procedural statutes and affecting existing cases, have we ever applied it or not applied it to a statute that had an effective date in the future? In some sense, don't all the statutes, unless they have the emergency clause, have an effective date in the future? So I guess I'm a little troubled by the argument. Even a statute that doesn't specify an effective date, as long as it doesn't have the emergency clause, it doesn't take effect until 90 days after the legislature. So,
but Your Honor,
I'm just trying to figure out how these two rules go together, if at all.
Your Honor, in this case, just think about the timing of the adoption of the law. You could theoretically have a scenario where the unicameral adopted on the 180th day on the Friday, the change in the statute, and whereas the party had 6 months to still effectuate service. You can't, in that situation, retroactively apply the law and deprive that party of a right and take away a substantive claim.
Well, it's not substantive, is it? It's procedural.
Well, it's substantive in the sense that you're depriving the right of access to the courts and their ability to rely upon a statute at the time of filing that says you got 6 months to effectuate service.
How is a dismissal without prejudice affect the substance?
It deprives the party of the right to access the court based upon the pleading that they filed. And it theoretically could ripen into a statute of limitations or some other issue because it relates back. In this case, I also don't think that there's any suggestion that actually the 180 days was missed because the timing falls on a Monday and the 180th day would have been, I believe, on a Saturday, even if you did retroactively apply. But that was never even argued by the appellee in this case. In fact, the appellee at page 32 essentially concedes. It says, even accepting Miller's position that section 25217 is the improper statutory provision authorizing dismissal of the action, in effect, the appellee has conceded that service was effectuated within the time allowed.
You don't think that's an argument, though? In other words, you don't think that's just for purposes of argument, you're saying?
I think it's effectively a concession. They didn't argue anywhere in their brief that there was not a failure to effectuate service on a timely basis.
I did ask about case authority, and I'm not sure that you ever specifically answered it. Have we ever had this situation?
I don't believe you've ever had this situation.
Thank you.
But the statute of limitations ran at the date that either of the dismissals occurred for either the bad faith claim or the statute or the breach of contract claim?
That would be fact dependent. And it would depend upon, because it's unnecessarily a bad faith claim, we believe there's a continuing duty under bad faith to adjust this claim in a fair and reasonable manner in accordance with Nebraska standards. That can continue into the future beyond just simply the date of the event of the storm. And relative to the breach of contract, there's not really a breach of contract until they fail to pay those sums that they're obligated to pay under the statute. You can have a storm on April 8th, 2013, the homeowner can submit their claim in January of 2014. It can go through that whole adjustment process. There can be the back and forth with the adjuster. And it may not be until the work's done in 2015 that the insurance company says, we're going to give you $20,000, whereas the contractor says $25,000. That's when the breach occurs, when there's a failure to pay the obligation.
Under your interpretation of the facts, how the statute of limitations ran when those marriages were dismissed on the two separate dates?
I don't believe so. because we believe that service was effectuated, what we respectfully submit that this case then becomes about the concept of whether or not this court means what it says when the court has said that a party is only required to set forth a short and plain statement of the claim. We're no longer operating under code pleading. All we have to allege is the existence of a promise and the breach of the promise to state a cause of action for breach of contract. The cases that are cited by the appellee in both their motion and their brief date back to the 1930s. There are 1933 cases when we were operating under code pleading. The Christensen v. Christensen case that they rely upon specifically talks about that case is decided under code pleading principles. The court goes out of its way to basically suggest that there would be a difference if that case were decided under notice pleading statutes. The Supreme Court in that case actually went so far as to talk about how under notice pleading these sort of issues, and it suggests critically, would be recited during the course of discovery. And they talk about how practicing lawyers complain that under notice pleading issues in many cases are not resolved until engaged in prolonged discovery. But the bottom line is Nebraska chose to depart from those standards. And if you look at the federal equivalent, even though they no longer use these, the old form that was under federal civil procedure, I believe it's 84, it was one page. It was just, we had a contract, they owed us this, we were damaged. That's as simple as a breach of contract claim is. And it's not appropriate to use a motion to make more definite as a substitute for discovery purposes. In this case, the court was directing things such as, we'll attach these assignments in the contracts and identify information that we may not even have access to, such as policy numbers. Nebraska unicameral struck down the statute that required the attachment of contracts in conjunction with the notice of the concept of code pleading. We believe that we met the standard of a short, plain statement.
Why did the appellant choose not to simply amend their complaint?
Because our intent was to stand on the complaint and get something for this court to review in terms of the bad faith action, because the bottom line is...
Did you form the district court of that?
We elected to stand on our complaint, and that was self-evident by virtue of the motions that were brought by the appellee at the time.
So if the court was not going to reverse itself, it was your intent to force it to dismiss your case so you could bring an appeal?
Well, we wanted to elect to stand on our pleading.
But that's what you would have to do to elect to stand on your pleading.
Yes.
So you getting the matter dismissed was the plan for your client, just not under 217.
Well, I mean, we never wanted it dismissed. We believe that we set forth a cause of action that was cognizable and should have survived a motion to dismiss. But in terms of obtaining some review of that decision, we wanted to get some process because, in effect, the case would be over and we would never have the opportunity to pursue any discovery in the bad faith. And we viewed that this is a mechanism by which we could achieve that. If possible, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Boothart?
Yes.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. And I'm going to apologize in advance for my appearance because I had an allergic reaction this morning, which resulted in me looking a bit like Homer Simpson. So I can tell you it's not contagious. And I've been through this before, but not during an oral argument. But I just hope it's not a distraction. So as the court clearly can tell from our pleading, we did not take the tact that, in fact, they had violated the six-month rule, the 180-day rule. Instead, we had simply said, regardless of whether the 180 days or the six-month applies here, the court certainly had a basis to dismiss the action without prejudice pursuant to 25601.
Nonetheless, it's an interesting question.
It absolutely is an interesting question. And there's actually all kinds of interesting questions in this case, but in an effort to keep it as simple as possible, because frankly, I don't think we have jurisdiction here. They've pled only that there's jurisdiction under 25-1902, yet as the court has recognized, there's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that any substantial right was affected by the dismissal without prejudice. And under Black's Law Dictionary, as recognized, I think in the Deck Cattle case, that means there is no prejudice. There is no right that is substantively affected. So
the entire action was dismissed when the final cause of action was dismissed on that 217 order, correct?
I'm sorry?
The entire action has been dismissed.
Absolutely.
Involuntarily dismissed.
Right, right. And in fact, I'll get to that, but all these issues about whether or not the bad faith claim should have been dismissed at that point in time based upon a failure to plead a cognizable claim actually becomes moot when the entire action is dismissed, because regardless of whether that bad faith case had been dismissed without prejudice at that point in time back in May, it would have been dismissed anyway in January when the court dismissed the entire action. So what we heard from counsel for the first time is that he does not believe any statute of limitations elapsed. So, in fact, he could have refiled the suit and we wouldn't even know about it, or he could walk out of here today and refile the suit. But even if some of those statute of limitations has lapsed, there's nothing in the record to indicate that that has occurred.
Is our jurisdiction dependent upon whether the statute of limitations has elapsed or not?
Yes and no. So I think a way to show that a substantial right was affected would be a dismissal without prejudice that somehow precludes a subsequent case being brought. And that would show that you've now lost a substantive right. You no longer have a right to bring the claim. As far as we all know in this courtroom, everybody that's listed in there, the 12 people in the petition, all still have valid claims and all still have all their claims. So the record does not, they have the burden of showing under 1902 that there has been a substantial right affected, and the mere dismissal without prejudice. And again, this is to read my own notes here. This is the Danes versus Essex case, where it held a dismissal without prejudice does not qualify under 1902 because, in fact, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't adjudicate anything. It simply resets the case. And so absent their showing, look, this dismissal without prejudice resulted in, for example, statute of limitations running or some other substantive right, they can walk down to the courthouse and refile this action and we start all over again, including all of their claims. So ultimately, I don't think we have jurisdiction here. And I don't think they've met any burden to show that they have jurisdiction under 1902. And the courts are clear, the cases are clear, that a mere dismissal without prejudice is not sufficient to show jurisdiction under 1902. In a case we didn't cite, but I found it last night, as I was preparing for this, there's a Wisuski, and I'm going to butcher that name, versus Charter First National Bank. And this is not cited in our briefs, but it is from this court. It's 290 Nebraska 721. It's a 2015 case. And that was a order denying arbitration and without prejudice. And the court found that was not an appealable order because the without prejudice nature of it is essentially a reset. So the opposing party had asked for time to conduct discovery before the court ruled on that motion. The court did not give them time to conduct discovery, but instead dismissed it without prejudice. This court then said, well, it's effectively doing the same thing. A dismissal without prejudice does not preclude you from doing discovery and then reasserting that arbitration would be appropriate.
Is it your position then that a party cannot stand on its pleadings, as your opponent has said they were attempting to do? They wanted to stand on the pleading they had simply and then get it reviewed whether that was allowed or not. Is it your position that's an impermissible tactic?
Well, you could always choose to stand on your pleading, but the question is that pleading and the subsequent procedural history going to qualify you for review under 1902? So the answer is, if what they're trying to do is essentially get a declaratory ruling from this case so that they can then proceed with the case and know with certainty what the law is, no, you can't do that. You have to have a final judgment, or you have to have a substantive right that was affected. And that effect has to be substantive as well. And there is nothing in the record or what we heard. In fact, we heard the opposite from counsel today, is that no statute of limitations have elapsed.
What if they can't plead additional facts? If the plaintiff doesn't have the additional facts that the court says are missing, what are they to do?
On the bad faith case? Or any case?
If they can't stand on the complaint and get review of it, it just languishes as dismissed without prejudice forever?
Well, if they don't have sufficient facts to plead a cause of action, then they don't have, regardless of whether you have a fact or notice pleading, you have to have facts that support your cause of action. So if you don't know whether or not you have a cause of action and you want to sue to do discovery to find that out, no, that's not appropriate. You have to have at least a factual basis under the rules to set forth a claim. So if all the facts that you know do not support a claim, then it is subject to dismissal. In this case, it was without prejudice, subject to dismissal.
But can you get appellate review of that determination?
Only if it qualifies under 1902.
And I beg your pardon. The premise is it not, when you stand on your complaint, is your belief it's sufficient?
Yeah, and that was the point I was attempting to make, is that you certainly can stand on your complaint if you believe it to sufficiently state a claim.
Isn't that what happened here?
It is, and they didn't state a claim, at least on the bad faith side of it. So they did state a claim or we didn't challenge it. We didn't challenge the claim that there had been an assignment of the proceeds of the policies and that they would have the right to proceed to collect on the damage that had occurred prior to that assignment being given. So they did plead a cause of action for that. The court then dismissed without prejudice the bad faith claim, which would have given them leave to amend at some point in time in the future had they developed additional facts in order to allow them to plead a cognizable claim. So obviously we have somewhat of a tortured procedural history here. We have a case that is filed in April of 2019, we have a summons that is served 182 days later. And then we have a motion that is filed in December of 2019. I'm sorry, 2018. And we have an order that comes down from the court dismissing without prejudice the bad faith claim, dismissing the statutory claim, which is not being raised here, and also order them to make a more definite statement. That's in May of 2019. And then, so we're not talking about, you know, they missed the 14 days to amend by a week or by 2 days. They ignored it for 6 months. And so that brings me right back again to the 180 days versus clearly the court had the basis to sua sponte dismiss the case under 25601 for a failure to amend as ordered back in May. And the reason, you know, we're guessing here.
Was there a hearing held on that motion?
There was not a hearing. We set a hearing, and the day after we set the hearing, the court dismissed it. So our assumption was that our motion and the basis for our motion was 25601. That was what the court was doing. But we really don't know, but it really doesn't matter because the court can affirm on any basis.
I agree. If they don't have to choose a basis, they don't have to state a basis. But if they do, don't we have to take it as that as the basis of where they dismissed upon, not upon 601?
You can absolutely assume that, and that may in fact be correct. It doesn't matter whether this court confirm it, because this court can affirm on any basis. So if a failure, a willful failure to respond to an order for 6 months does not qualify under 25601 to dismiss it again without prejudice, which is what happened. So this court has, whether the stated basis is appropriate or not, there's obviously a valid basis to dismiss it under 25601.
Is a dismissal under 25601 an exercise of the court's discretion? In other words, it's not a mandatory.
It is an exercise of discretion.
And can we really review that for an abuse of discretion if the reason the court gave was a self-executing mandatory dismissal under 25?
This court could absolutely review it for abuse of discretion based upon the record in front of it. And what the record says is we had an order in May of 2019. We had a willful ignoring, and apparently.
But the district court didn't exercise discretion. It determined it recognized a purported self-executing dismissal under.
That's what the order purports to state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, around 28 seconds.
28 seconds, Mr. Beck. We'll give you a whole minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, we respectfully submit that this court does have jurisdiction under 25-1902. The order of dismiss found it at the transcript of page 73 says this action stands dismissed. Now, even though it's without prejudice, it still stands dismissed. The action that we filed stands dismissed. By being forced to file a new action, then that can affect our relative rights that may present issues such as statute of limitations. But the bottom line is that's still an appealable order under the precise language of the statute, because that decision determines the action and prevents a judgment in that case.
Have you filed any action on behalf of the individuals listed in Exhibit A or on behalf of the
defendant? No, because we're seeking relief through the appeal. We think that decision directing dismissal under 25217 was an error. The 180 days ran on a Saturday. If you even apply the statute retroactively, we don't think that's appropriate. We were within the 6 months. No one suggested in terms of the defense that we didn't timely effectuate service. So that service was effective. But then when the court dismisses the action, it prevents a judgment in that case that was pending before that case that we presented to that court, that we said, here's our short, plain statement of relief. Allow us to go pursue discovery. And the court said no.
Lose in this court, can you go back and amend your pleadings and file again?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think it depends on what this court decides in terms of the decision. If it says 25217 was an error and remains without further comment, then I guess we go back to that court and we assess it. We think by virtue of the decision dismissing this case, It made the action ripe for determination to determine whether, I mean, that's why there's no case law on motions to make more definite before the Nebraska Supreme Court. That's why I have to look to the federal court decisions, because there's an absence of a mechanism to achieve that. But this is a case where you can say, do you really mean what you say in Tyron versus North Platte and other cases, which, where you say you only have to relay a short, plain statement, and you shouldn't be deciding cases on a motion to dismiss or motion to make more definite level if the development of the case and new theories could be aided with the development of additional facts during the course of discovery.
One last chance. What's the substantial right that's been affected by this dismissal, whether it's under 25217 or 25601?
The right is the ability to prosecute the case at 183029 that we filed, that we are thereby deprived of, that we may now, by virtue of filing later after the court dismissed that action, may be risking a potential determination on statute of limitations. In addition, there's a portion, if you look at the court's decision, where she did dismiss with prejudice some of the claims. The statutory claims, she said, those are dismissed with prejudice in her prior order, which also said the bad faith claim was without prejudice. So relative to those claims, it is prejudicial to us. We are prevented from any effective review because, at least with respect to a portion of the case that we brought before the court, there's been a final determination.
What was the basis for that dismissal?
The court concluded that there was no private cause of action under those statutes. And our basic contention is those statutes.
That's a failure to state a claim.
Yes.
And you didn't. Isn't that a dismissal without prejudice? Doesn't that not affect a substantial right?
Well, the decision says it's with prejudice relative to those claims.
Can it be with prejudice when it dismisses failure to state?
As a plaintiff's attorney, I don't want to risk refiling and then the court coming back and saying, well, you never appealed that. That case was dismissed. That case was adjudicated. Within that case, there was this determination that those portions are dismissed with prejudice. I know a defense is going to come back and say, relative to those claims, that's res judicata and collateral estoppel, and you're done. And so to get effective review, we have to appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in this case. Counsel, when you're leaving the courtroom, please leave by the side door to my left and continue to abide by distancing and mask appropriate conduct. Thank you very much. Our next case this morning is Windham versus Kroll, and this will be argued by WebEx.